For decades, I have combined in one person an interest in science and policy and politics. From my earliest memories, I've been interested in how the world works, that's science, and how people get along, that's politics. In addition to being a research scientist trained in physics, a teacher at the university level, I've also been, for the past 16 years, until this year, an elected member of the United States Congress, of the House of Representatives. And I took over as the chief of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, an organization that I think very highly of, that I have been involved in for 40 years before I came as the CEO.
Can you tell me what you've learned specifically that you could share with other scientists about the mechanisms of policy making? I remember once Jane Lipchenko, a marine biologist, saying that her experience was that she'd already learned to swim with sharks as a marine biologist. So when she was mixing with policymakers, she found that relatively easy. But joking aside, what particular lessons do you think you learned that you could share?
Dr. Lipchenko's comment is certainly amusing. In fact, I think most policymakers, when it comes to science, are not sharks. The word that I would apply maybe is clueless. Policymakers, like the general public, value the fruits of science. They think that scientists must be awfully smart people, but they don't have a clue about what it takes to support science, nor do they really have an appreciation of how important science is, or could be, in dealing with the problems of the day, improving people's quality of life. Our society, the AAAS, has the motto, advancing science, serving society. So we are constantly thinking about what does it take to advance science, to sustain science, to attract good people to practice science, to maintain the openness that's necessary for science, to maintain consistent support and appreciation among the public. And serving society, we are constantly thinking about to what use this science can be put. Well, it is important in addressing questions of climate change, of energy future, of, well, to choose a current issue, migration, the whys and whats of migration, why people, you know, the causes, the nature, the effects of migration. You ask what message I would have. Well, for scientists, the message would be, don't try to talk about your research as something that you should simplify so that they will begin to understand it, the policymakers, that is. Because the job is not to say, let me tell you what you cannot possibly understand. That only insults the policymaker. And any amount of simplification only does not solve the basic problem. What the scientist should do is help the policymaker understand the importance of evidence. Understand how science works. You're talking about perhaps your specific research area, if you like, but what the policymaker needs to understand is that evidence-based thinking is better thinking. Conclusions reached and solutions arrived at through evidence-based thinking are clearer and more effective. And that's the point. Because policymakers forget that too often and make decisions on the basis of their ideology. My message for policymakers is to realize that scientists, by and large, are altruistic. They are not just seeking to get more funding for their research. Most scientists are driven by curiosity to understand how the world works, and they have a real desire to see that their knowledge is put to good use, and policymakers should welcome that.
So how do we enable this in countries that, for example, have very weak science infrastructure, but possibly very powerful governments that need to make very rapid changes. Yeah.
Well, there is much that science can do to facilitate the solution of international problems, sometimes directly addressing those international problems, often indirectly providing, you know, the common language of science and the neglect of political borders among scientists allows them to establish communication that can be very valuable in reaching international agreements. We saw that, for example, in the five-party talks with Iran on the nuclear agreement. The scientists could reach agreements that the diplomats and politicians couldn't. And in the other direction, collaborating on science among nations helps promote the science, helps make it more effective, helps sustain it to do those things that make science so valuable. So capacity building is something that we want to promote. I would argue that the best foreign aid, the best international development aid that can be given to a country is scientific capacity building. The ability for that country to develop the indigenous capability to do good research. That is invaluable. And there are so many examples in 20th and 21st century history that should help people understand that this capacity building is well worth the investment.
The climate change debate.
Yeah.
Would you say that we, humanity, are actually dithering on this, or are we acting?
We should have acted 20, 30, 40 years ago. Certainly in the countries like the United States that were already by that time emitting lots of greenhouse gases. And we should have done it in a way that made it possible for the countries that were developing and that would be emitting more and more greenhouse gases could get on a different path. Unfortunately, we haven't done that.
So is that a failure of the dialogue between science and policy?
Yes, I think so.
Can it be remedied?
Well, it is being remedied. The COP21 conference, we've got all of these nations on board. Most of the public, even in recalcitrant countries like the United States, most of the public now understands, number one, the climate is changing. Number two, humans are responsible, largely. Three, that it is costly in lives and dollars. And now almost, maybe a majority, understand point four, that there are some things that can and should be done about it.
Professor Holt, thank you very much.
Thanks.